Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The U.S. COVID death toll stands at about 577,000 as both cases and deaths mount in India, Brazil, and elsewhere around the world. Europe continues to struggle as it has for some time in this pandemic. Inflation concerns are on the rise as major companies in the United States, like Boeing, as well as European companies like Airbus, report earnings. Air travel trends continue to pick up in the United States, and all eyes are on where traffic goes worldwide. Joining us to discuss the week on world markets are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners in London, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy here in Washington, D.C. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Delighted to be here, Vago.
Good to be here.
And before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, our coverage of strategy, General Motors Defense sponsors our coverage of technology, and Rafael Advanced Defense Systems sponsors our air and missile defense coverage. Interesting week. Inflation concerns obviously growing, air travel trends picking up. Obviously, the world's attention and hearts go out to India, as well as to Brazil and elsewhere on the planet, where the COVID pandemic is a lot worse than it is in the United States and in the United Kingdom at this point, as vaccinations have picked up nations promising aid. On world markets, inflation concerns are obviously rising, with none other than the Oracle of Omaha, Warren Buffett, raising the alarm that Berkshire Hathaway is really starting to struggle as a red hot economy grows, concerns about whether rental cars will be available, and other challenges across the supply chain, right? Ford taking massive charges because of computer chip shortages. Obviously, that was because of a fire at a chip plant. Ron, walk us through where we are on broader markets and how it all stands to impact aerospace and defense on a week when a lot of the biggest names reported. But let's start the conversation off with inflation concerns and what all of this might mean.
Yeah, we've heard from companies, I guess, across not just the industrial complex that input costs are going up. You just pick your input cost. We've seen raw material inflation across the spectrum. Now, for aerospace companies, for the most part, it's a pass-through, not always for suppliers, it is for the OEs, but many suppliers fall under the umbrella of their OEs, and in some cases, it can be a pass-through. So it's less of a concern for commercial aero. In defense, it's a pass-through, right? So we don't really worry about it too much on defense. But when you think about industrial end markets, it's a real concern. Lumber prices have gone up. Most metals, I can't think of a metal where you haven't seen inflation in the raw materials. And then in multiple earnings calls, you've heard companies talk about it. Now, this goes hand in hand with what we've seen in the interest rate market we've been talking about for a while. You know, interest rates seem to be settling in, right, at least for the time being, at this for the 10-year treasury, kind of around 1.6. The thinking is, our economists are thinking it's going to go higher, and they're not alone in that. And the reason for that is, typically, interest rates will chase inflation up. So if we see inflation, and inflation that's more than kind of just temporary because of a demand surge, but more kind of underlying inflation related to too many dollars chasing too few assets, in kind of simple terms, you'll see rates continue to go higher too. Now, again, for our space, on the defense side, there's really no impact on commercial. It'll make rents on airplanes more expensive, financing airplanes more expensive, that kind of thing. We're not quite there yet. But one of the indicators that I like to look at, and one of the stock technical persons, analysts, I guess, technical persons, that's not a very good way to say about it, but one of the analysts that focus on stock technicals, mentioned to me years ago, if you want a good gauge of kind of what's going on in the market, just look at Bank of America stock. And because Bank of America is just a broad measure of a lot of things, but broadly speaking, what drives earnings in Bank of America is our loan book, and generally our loan book does better when rates go up. And if you look at how Bank of America has performed this year, I think we're up something like 35-40%. And that is really just the market discounting in what it sees in terms of inflation and interest rates.
Sash, you're looking at this from a European markets perspective. Talk to us about what the inflation picture looks like sitting over in Europe and how it potentially impacts our entire ecosystem.
In Europe, it would be a nice problem to have. In the whole of Europe at the moment, continental Europe is in recession, and inflation isn't the priority, or indeed the something that a lot of people are talking about, particularly at the financial and the political level. There are questions about the pace of the recovery, and hence about the degree of quantitative easing that the central banks will provide over the coming quarters. And different countries are coming out of the pandemic at different paces, and hence, there are different monetary issues. But in a broad sense, inflation isn't something that European policymakers are worried about. They will be, in a quarter or two's time, but not at the moment. Interesting feedback, though, coming from some of the aerospace companies that reported this week, who very much echoed what Ron said. If you are somewhere at the tier one level or above, inflation is a pass-through. It's a bit like value-added tax or something. You just pass it down. I mean, in fact, they can pass it through to the customer, and the customer sucks it up as part of the purchase price and generally barely notices it. John Leahy, the former chief operating officer of Airbus, used to say that escalation clauses, which reflect inflation, are sort of one of the dirty little secrets of the civil aircraft industry, that it means that this is, the industry at the very top level is incredibly unworried about inflation. And probably if they can keep their costs down, a bit of inflation doesn't do them as much harm as you might think.
Richard, give us your sense.
I understand why people are sanguine about inflation of the commercial aero sector because of pass-throughs and because of, escalation clauses and whatever else. But I have to wonder because, prices are notoriously sticky in our industry. And by, most of the, there's this cottage industry of people who do aircraft prices and, just trying to guesstimate, given a lack of proper market intelligence, how much people actually paid for jets last year. And there are about three or four good sources who do that. And all of them agree that new jetliner pricing took a real nosedive last year. Hardly surprising when, of course, Airbus and Boeing were desperate to move metal out the door. Those prices are going to be sticky. And I'm wondering if, depending upon the severity of inflation in terms of all those inputs, if it keeps going. And, there are many types of inflation. Some of it could just be a price recovery from the blow that prices took last year, or some of it could be genuinely, as Ron says, just a function of too much cash chasing too few things. That would be bad. And if you really did have this negative shock to pricing last year, inflation is severe enough, you could have a scenario where, despite escalation clauses and pass-throughs, you simply have a bit of a hit to profitability as a result of this. And it's also, because of the stickiness of those pricing, how do you get pricing power back once you've started selling your, jets for 30-something million or what have you, which is, I think what took place with the MAXes and even some NEOs last year. So I'm a bit concerned.
Ron, from, everybody obviously tracks treasury bonds to sort of figure out what the inflationary trends are going to be. What sort of activity are we seeing? And, is anybody talking about how much inflation we're likely to see and how bad it could be, right? I mean, that one of the challenges of the Fed is, right, it just continues to print, everybody has a tendency of thinking about what we're spending. The Fed also has a huge amount of things that it can do, but the history of inflation is governments can try to control it, but it tends to have kind of a mind of its own, especially if the market thinks it can make more money in an inflationary situation than not. I mean, unfortunately, that's just a reality. I mean, any sense on what folks are saying, both publicly and privately, on all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's been a broad debate we've seen in the press, right? I mean, you've had folks like Larry Summers come out and say, hey, inflation's going to be a problem. You mentioned Warren Buffett, and then you've heard other folks that are, less worried about it. We haven't seen inflation in a very long time, so it is an open debate. I think in the economics community, you can kind of see it in the press. there's a bit of a debate about it. Broadly, and to be clear, I'm not an economist at the bank or anything like that, but right. Inflation can be a pretty nonlinear thing. It can be tricky to put back in the box if it gets out. I think one thing most people will agree with, though, however, the Fed tends to be late, right? It's typically not early. It tends to be late on many of the moves that it makes. Hopefully that won't be the case here. But the U.S. economy seems to be doing quite well. There's been a lot of stimulus thrown at it, and there'll be some more, it looks like, thrown at it. And that's just going to make it even hotter, and that tends to fan the flames of inflation. Jerome Powell said they're not targeting a specific rate. I think what 2%, but if it goes above it for a while, that's okay. They want it to be around 2% on average. So we'll see. But it is clearly an open debate.
And obviously, right? I mean, the challenge is cost of borrowing goes up, interest payments go up, and especially if you're a government that owes $23 trillion, your borrowing costs get out of whack. And then very, very quickly, you're in a situation where you've got to start making some big national decisions, including potentially reduce social spending and defense spending, right? I mean, a situation where the United States hasn't been in certainly for a very long time, especially something driven by markets, right? And rising borrowing costs that we haven't seen in a long time.
Could I quickly, do you mind if I inject something here? Not at all, please. You know, one thing we need to keep in mind here is that we've become, as the commercial aero industry is, sort of a poster child for deflation. You know, for 20 years now, we've been losing 2% per year or so in real pricing. The nominal price of a jet is actually lower than it was in 2000. In other words, we've been stimulating demand. And assuming that we can maintain profitability, that is to say, if pricing can even keep track with costs, even then, we're no longer going to be stimulating demands for deflation. And that's going to be a moment to watch.
Sash, you want to add something?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point that Richard has made. And this was something that was touched on by Airbus management at the Q1 call. And I think this is going to be probably one of the most important issues over the next decade or so. One of the reasons why this industry has been so deflationary is that pretty much everything in the last two decades has essentially been relatively incremental developments of the same technology. All aircraft look the same now. They are all tubes of varying lengths with two engines underneath the wings. And Airbus made it very clear that the next aircraft they produce, all new clearly rather than derivative, but let's say it's a next generation single aisle, is going to look very different. And from their point of view, what worries them at the moment is that the capital costs and the capital expenditure costs for that aircraft are going to be totally unlike what they have spent on a program within, you know, most management's memory, because the fuselage is unlikely to be a tube. If the fuselage is unlikely to be a tube, you know, just a straight constant cross-section tube, then the aircraft will not be very scalable. So you're going to have to get the point design right, because you can't shrink it or stretch it to, you know, to try to touch the sweet spot. And that has been the strategy that's been incredibly successful for Boeing and Airbus in the last two decades. And these things are going to have very high tooling costs, because you're going to have strange shapes, you know, ovals, rhomboids, whatever the hell it is, flying wings, all of which require specific tooling for the composites that will make them. And that is going to utterly break the mold, pun intended, of the deflationary manufacturing environment that we and the whole industry have got used to over the last two decades. And I think Airbus is starting to be aware of that. I don't think the rest of the industry is. And therefore, whenever I see these wonderful high school and university proposals to produce exotic looking aircraft because they'll have unbelievable economics, they're talking about flying economics. None of them talking about manufacturing economics. But if you don't get the manufacturing economics right, these things are going to be too expensive, period.
Ron, I, as our resident aeronautical engineer, thought I'd bring you in to weigh in on that, right? I mean, is there a need to go away from the standard round oval tube and two engines hanging off the wings?
It's a pretty darn good design, honestly, right? That's why it hasn't changed all that much. There's other, if you're going to fly subsonically at the speeds that we are accustomed to. The tube with the swept wing is a pretty darn good design. Now, you know, as you know, there's been, you know, talks about, you know, lifting bodies and that sort of stuff, because you can get more volume efficiently, that kind of thing. But, you know, the tube with wings is pretty darn good. And when you go back to kind of support that statement, and you go back over the last 50 years, what have you seen advancement in? Well, clearly engine technology, engine reliability, fuel burn, that kind of stuff, right? I mean, you don't need to put four engines on an airplane anymore because you're going to lose one on a flight across the Atlantic, right? Like, it's, you know, engines have gotten really reliable. Avionics have made a huge difference in, you know, in aviation safety and what you can do with avionics and pilot situational awareness and, you know, so on and so forth. And materials, right? I mean, composites and even, you know, very advanced metallics, you know, going from aluminum to aluminum, lithium, that kind of thing. But the tube with wings, it's a pretty darn good shape for what it's got to do. So, I mean, so maybe it's an ogive with wings, or it's a tube-like thing with wings. It's not a perfect tube. But it's hard for me to see to fly at, you know, at, you know, Mach 0.8, 0.85, wherever, you know, we typically fly, that you're going to move that far away from a tube with wings, because there's so many advantages operationally, manufacturally, and it, you know, it's a good design.
Right. I mean, blended wing body and all of that stuff, you know, can carry more, but it tends to be slower. It has more drag. I mean, there are a whole bunch of other challenges when people are like, oh, you know, why aren't we flying in a giant blended wing body? There are reasons for that. We have more structure. Let's go to Richard. Do you want to weigh in on that before we quickly transition to air travel and then earnings?
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic. And, you know, what are the reasons for going away from that, the current paradigm of tube and wing? And one is ultra high bypass, you know, suspended under trapezoidal wings or something. Jury's really out on that. In terms of, you know, whether or not the weight and drag begins to override the bypass advantage. And the other is possibly maybe to accommodate hydrogen, but that, oh boy, there's so many opposing voices that I respect. So I tend to think that the, I understand Sasha's concerns for the higher CapEx and inferior manufacturing economics of a radically divergent airframe shape, but I tend to think that the tube and wing might have another generation in it.
Let's transition to air travel figures. Who wants to start us off about, you know, where we are now and what our expectations are, right? I mean, worldwide, there's a lot of attention being paid as to what's next from your guys' standpoint. Where are we going, just by way of an update on a week that the big companies, both Airbus and Boeing, reported?
Well, I'd point out the airlines also reported, or at least some of them here in the U.S.
And, absolutely true. Yeah. Great for bringing that up.
Yeah. I mean, the airline reports here in the U.S. reflect, I guess, an ongoing K. The K-shaped recovery is getting even more severe. The lower, you know, part being international, the higher one being domestic, the higher one, more importantly, being U.S. By all accounts, the U.S. is coming nicely back. And then international, of course, not so much at all, even domestic markets. And of course, the tragedy taking place in India kind of jeopardizes the outlook for the Gulf carriers that have always been, well, the biggest customer for years now of Twin Isles. And that impacts something like 20 to 25% of their customer base, you know, very damaging. The other thing I'd point out, of course, IATA this week increased its loss for the year for the world's airlines to $42 billion. That's considerably worse than expected. So we're having a rough ride back on the recovery road here.
And should point out, right, Delta got, you know, was keeping the center seat open. So social distancing is now, the last vestige of it is over on a major American carrier. You know, it's interesting, though, right? I mean, I can't remember who had the story about, you know, now's a great time to launch an airline. I don't know. Is it a good, you know, what is it best way to turn a billionaire into a millionaire is to launch an airline? Ron, talk to us a little bit about travel trends and then Sash, and then let's quickly get into earnings. Go ahead. Or travel forecast, whatever you guys have in terms of where you see volume and traffic going.
Yeah. I mean, our forecast honestly really hasn't changed all that much. I mean, we're still looking for 2020, you know, 2019 globally, you know, back to, you know, 2023 back to global levels, you know, what we're in 2019, with, you know, the domestic markets picking up first. And that's what we're seeing. I would say the only snag in our forecast is Europe has been tougher than I think, you know, we were anticipating. So we'll see how that plays out. You know, our hope is that we see Europe follow the U.S. Just delayed by some time. But we really haven't changed our outlook. You know, 2023, we get back to 2019 levels. And that's, you know, what we've dialed into most of our commercial aerospace models. So hopefully that's right, or we'll have some changes to make.
Sash?
I think that there is the risk of applying the U.S. airlines experience in a way that actually, and assuming that that maps over, you know, onto the experience of other airlines. And I'm afraid we call it the World Series syndrome. U.S. airlines are head and shoulders above everybody else in the world, but they are not the world. And, you know, European airlines are just in a dreadful state. There's not a single European airline at the moment that is objectively doing well. And so it's not doing as well as they have done, you know, they expected to do at the start of the first quarter. The question for European airlines is when they get refinanced and by whom and how much. Airbus were very, very clear. I mean, they just said, look, India shows quite how fragile this recovery is. It may be that India is solvable and dealable with, but, you know, the Indian market is, you know, as Richard rightly points out, we focus on the Indian domestic market as our peril because the impact on the long haul market is at least as important for India. But also India has got some of the airlines that have placed some of the biggest, whether responsible or not, orders, particularly with Airbus, but to an extent with Boeing as well. And I, you know, what I thought was interesting, just comments from management this week, companies are clearly in Europe still cautious about the international environment. You know, as an example, MTU, they have a very bifurcated forecast. 23 for domestic travel, i.e. for narrow bodies, 24, 25, and I think it's slipping to 25 for wide bodies. Hitherto, they've talked about wide bodies being about a year behind narrow bodies. They clearly now see that gapping out at the moment. And that, you know, that's, I think, you know, given that they are pretty broadly exposed to Airbus and Boeing, they don't have a particular you know, a particular bias one way or another, although they're most exposed in wide bodies to General Electric. But that would, you know, that I think that sort of caution is really interesting in this regard. The other example, the interesting thing that we've been looking at, because the UK has done pretty well in vaccinations, but UK air travel, and the UK is almost entirely an international market, UK air travel is one of the least recovered markets in the world. We're still at 10% of 2019 levels. And that shows you how long it takes for international travel to turn around, even when the vaccination programs work. I'm worried that I'm seeing everything through a very, very half empty glass because of where I am. But I don't think this is, you know, a particularly unusual view from Europe and the Middle East at the moment.
Let's go to earnings. We've discussed bits and pieces of this. Sash, great job sort of sprinkling it across all of your comments, whether about MTU or Airbus. Ron, let's start off with U.S. earnings. Obviously, Boeing reported a lot of interest, created by your report before earnings. You know, for what it's worth, created some news. Your question to Dave Calhoun, you know, he was very bullish on business transformation, but you pushed him, I think appropriately so, on, okay, but the status of the company's most important programs are all, you know, either somewhat or worrisomely troubled, whether it's the 737 MAX, whether it's the 777X, whether it's the 787, and indeed KC-46, right? I mean, which is a 767 that they've only been building for, you know, like 30 years. You know, talk to us a little bit about Boeing earnings and where, you know, we are as well, and just get everybody to quickly comment on Boeing as well, and what the key takeaways were. Go ahead.
Yeah. So quickly on Boeing, they burned about another $3.5 billion in the quarter. Their defense numbers were okay. When you look at the other defense contractors we'll talk about, I mean, you know, it was just okay. They delivered some 737s in the quarter and some maxes. They reiterated their target of getting back to 31 per month of deliveries in early 2022, and then reevaluating from there. And there's a handful of 787s that trickled out. They did suggest, however, given that they have 100 787s in inventory and they're still building 5 a month, that they would deliver the majority of the 787s that are in inventory plus what's coming off the line by the end of the year. That seems optimistic to me, honestly, right? I mean, that's a lot of aircraft in the current environment, particularly wide bodies. And you know, notwithstanding that the 787 is a wonderful airplane and there's demand for it, in the current environment, it doesn't seem like there's that much demand for it, honestly. So we'll see if that plays out. And then, you know, a little bit on my question. I mean, it is unclear to me, and they didn't explain very well, and we spoke about this in our post-earnings note, what business transformation has to do with addressing maybe some of the more key underlying questions around capital deployment decisions and investments made to get where they got today. And I think the most important thing is, I mean, you can look at a company in hindsight and kind of beat on it, but the key is going forward, how is this not going to happen again? And I think that's the most important question. You know, if indeed they do launch another airplane, okay, cool. Well, how can we feel good that, you know, it's going to go much smoother, right? I mean, to be fair, if you look at Airbus and the A350, and I think Sash can speak to this, it went pretty well, right? I mean, there was a little bit of delay here and there, but all in, I mean, that program went pretty much, you know, straight down the fairway.
Well the second time, right? I mean, the first time was sort of an aborted start, and then they sort of hit the reset button.
The new airplane, right? I mean, the first one was sort of a remake of a A330, right? But you know, the all carbon fiber airplane kind of went quite well, right? So it's possible you can do it, and I guess that's what we're going to want to get a feel for. That when, you know, Boeing does the next aircraft, that okay, you know, we know what happened here, and we won't make similar mistakes on the future airplane. And they haven't explained that to the investment community at large.
Sash?
I think that, I mean, one thing, the thing that really worried me about the tone of some of the comments coming from Boeing management on the call and, you know, quoted in the press after the results was that they did not give an impression that they recognized that they have a problem. And if you are going to deal with a severe problem, whether it is a personal problem or a business problem, accepting that you have a problem is pretty damn fundamental to going and sorting it out. And they didn't do that. And for as long as that is the case, for as long as they think that they're doing things pretty well, or that it's the other guy's fault, or they're doing as badly as the other guys, and so that's okay, then this is a company that is in a very, very fragile state in terms of the decisions that management take and the implications of those for whether they can turn the business around and recover market share. Because at the moment, the market share is 40% and probably slipping. And, you know, this idea that you can have an aspiration to get, or, you know, you hope to, or you expect to get back to 50% share on narrow bodies. There's all sorts of things that I hope to. Most of them are fantasy. You know, there has to be something more realistic to actually get back to a 50% market share other than buying your way there. And I don't think anybody would want that. And I can't see why that's the case. To take Ron's specific point on the A350, I think it's a really good case. Airbus made a stupid product decision early on the original A350. They recognized that it was wrong, and they told people it was wrong, and they took an enormous charge because it was wrong, and they pissed off a lot of customers. And they then went back and completely redesigned it, and the only thing that was the same was the three digits, 350. But everything else about the new aircraft, the current aircraft, was different. And Ron's absolutely right. Actually, the A350, as they called the XWB development program, once it was rebooted, worked well. What was interesting is one of the reasons why it worked well is that they learned and had learned a huge number of again, brutally expensive lessons from the A350. And so they had people who, sorry, from the A380, and they had people from the A380 program who had screwed up royally or seen the effects of screwing up royally, who said, never again on our watch, and who were put into positions of, you know, senior management to make sure that they didn't make the same mistakes again. So acceptance that you have screwed up is really important. When it happens, the transformation in terms of delivery of programs can be really impressive. I don't see that happening at Boeing at the moment. And I thought that the comments that Mr. Calhoun made this week were really very, very dispiriting in terms of seeing Boeing get back to, or you know, whether Boeing can get back to doing what it used to do really well again.
Richard, your sense?
I just completely echo everything Sash and Ron have just said. This is kind of the start of a tragedy in the making, or maybe we're middle stages of a tragedy in the making. And the one thing that really hits me about comments from both Airbus and Boeing is that, you know, it, rightly or wrongly, Airbus projects a future. Programs are in gestation. They are being dealt with, and they're talking about new technologies. I don't necessarily agree with a hydrogen future, but they're talking about new technologies, new concepts, new things to do. It's a company that's still recognizably an engineering company. Boeing is talking about financial tactics, management for the next quarter or two, clearing inventories, things like that. It's not really clear that they have an eye on the future, or indeed any kind of strategy other than returning to, well, the most they can get back to in terms of, well, returning cash flow to shareholders. That's it. So I think everything about the company at this point, yes, as Sash says, they need to admit, they need to come out and say, we've made big mistakes in program management and execution, and we need to change the structure of the company, the management of the company. We need to promote engineers to positions of power, and we need to start thinking about a future beyond the next couple of quarters.
I mean, it's a little bit like, AA, right? I mean, you first have to acknowledge you have a problem before you can start fixing the problem. And I think that that's the challenge. And what's funny is the company somehow thinks the world is beating up on them, and it's not. I think everybody wants the company to succeed. And it's frustrating people to see Boeing, it was long considered sort of a national engineering treasure, right? I mean, somebody once told me in the Pentagon, you know, what are national strategic discriminators, and Boeing's engineering horsepower was regarded as one of those things. And it's problematic when America's aerospace leader, certainly on the commercial side of the business, but also an important defense and a vitally important space company, seems to be tripping. And unfortunately, management has a tendency sometimes of considering these to be personal criticisms, as opposed to saying, look, you know, it's a challenge we have to address. Ron, take us through the rest of U.S. earnings. Time is winding down. And then, Sash, I want to get your sense as well of a little bit of the brass tacks. Ron, walk us through how the rest of the group performed and what it means.
And just one quick last thing on Boeing. I mean, you know, the strong critiques come because we want them to win, right? I mean, I just want to reiterate that, right? That's the goal. So when you look across the rest of the sector, we saw some broad trends, right? So Northrop reported, General Dynamics reported, Raytheon Technologies reported, L3Harris reported, to name some of the big ones, among many others, right? So to be fair, I can't get to all of them, but there were some broad trends. So I would say, one, Northrop was probably the champion in the quarter because they had the strongest organic growth. Adjusting for a couple extra days in the quarter and some divestiture stuff, their growth year over year was almost 6.5%, it's pretty outstanding. I mean, if you put the days back in the quarter, it was almost 12%, which is kind of eye popping. But across most of the defense contractors, we saw at least a couple percent growth, and then some other themes that emerged in the quarter across most of the contractors. They're increasing dividends. They're buying back shares. They're generating cash. They're all forecasting for the year something like kind of 2 to 4%, top line growth. So they all seem to be doing reasonably well. One of the more interesting points is, and this kind of first came out in the Lockheed quarter that was reported last week, but then we saw it flow through the other companies. The American Rescue Plan Act actually reduced pension contributions for most of the defense contractors. It changed a little bit of how they do that calculation. So that freed up some cash that would have to flow into the pensions that isn't now. And then I would be remiss if I didn't highlight Raytheon Technologies as well. Their defense business really supported the commercial business, right? Their commercial business was broadly kind of in line with other commercial businesses that all are doing modestly better, but it's still tough out there, right? But their defense business really supported them. And even they are going to increase their dividend and increase their share buyback from the performance in the defense business. So I would say broadly across defense, it was a good week. And if you look at share price performance, and that was reflected in the share prices, Northrop was the champ on the week. It was up, almost a little over 4%. The rest of the defense guys were maybe up about half of that, maybe 2%. Boeing was down on the week. So it was, that's how the market in the end was the arbiter of how earnings performance went.
And how did Greg respond to your question at Raytheon when you noted that his engine was mentioned 39 times in a hearing?
Yeah, they acknowledge that, and they went through the program, the work that they're doing to address that. So we'll see how that plays out. He walked through a little bit of the technology, and was cognizant of what was going on. I mean, he clearly didn't blow off the question, and kind of went through it in a public forum. It was only just a couple of minutes per person. I think it's hard to go into great detail, but he addressed the question.
Right. Sash, if you have any comments on Boeing and Richard, why don't we kind of get those out of the way and then dive into Airbus really quickly, as well as Safran, MTU, and whatever has to be said about Saab, because it was a busy week, and then have you guys all follow up on that as well. Sash?
The only thing I've got to add on Boeing, I wholeheartedly agree with Ron's final point. We want Boeing to get back to where back to where it used to be. A duopoly is a hell of a lot healthier than a monopoly for this whole industry. And to do that, that needs Boeing to recover and to recover in a strong and sustainable way. European results now. Three of the four big European civil aerospace companies reported Q1 results this week: Airbus, Safran, MTU. Interestingly, if you look at the share prices, Airbus ended the week, although there was a degree of volatility during the week, pretty much flat, 99 euros. And that tells you the market just doesn't think the recovery is coming through to Airbus the way that Airbus says it's going to. Interestingly, the most used word, we've done word counts today, F-135 counts in congressional hearings. The most used phrase that Airbus used on their call today was tipping, or this week rather, was tipping point, that the industry, or particularly the narrow body industry, is close to a tipping point. I actually think they mean an inflection point, but that's a minor detail. Right. But where narrow body demand will structurally start to rise and production rates will start to rise. And then when they were asked questions on the call about, is it this quarter, next quarter, third quarter, whatever, they are still cautious about that. So they are hearing the bullish comments being made by US airlines. They are looking at the much less bullish comments being made by European airlines. They're looking at what's happening in India. And they're trying to work out, when does that net turn positive, and what does this mean? But they are poised to press the button on production rate increases for the A320 family, and actually they've already done it quietly for the A220. That will not just be the rate increases for this year, but they're talking about a steep ramp up next year and the year beyond. And I think the market investors were a bit more cautious about this, because it's really hard to have Airbus saying narrow body is going great, and then they look at big purchases of narrow body aircraft, whether that's Indigo in India or Air France, Lufthansa, BA in British Airways, and IAG in Europe, and they don't see airlines that are that keen on buying a whole ton more narrow bodies than whatever they've got on order at the moment. So that really was the big debate that went on for Airbus. Safran and MTU both ended the week net a bit higher, MTU higher than Safran. Safran is a company dragged in two directions. On the one hand, fabulous narrow body engine franchise, because they've got half of CFM in international. And clearly That's a business that should do well from increased flying hours anywhere in the world. But what they're being dragged back by is their interiors business. Remember, this was the old Zodiac business they bought a couple of years back. And that's had its lowest quarter in the entire pandemic, and it's probably still going down. Airlines just don't want to spend on interiors. It's money wasted for them at the moment. And remember, spending on interiors, whether it's seats, bins, galleys, lavatories, whatever, heavily concentrated to wide body and hence to international travel, nobody's spending on that. By contrast, MTU has got the good bits of Safran, although in their case, their exposure is to the Pratt & Whitney geared turbofan, but they don't have the interiors business. And they were, you know, the top performing of the three stocks in the week. It wasn't a great Q1. It actually was a really weak Q1, but their cash flow was good and they didn't change guidance. And I think a lot of people went into the call worried that they might cut guidance, having had a fairly downbeat annual general meeting a week ago. They didn't do that, and therefore there was a sigh of relief.
Richard, your reflections on all of this?
Oh, I just point out the continuing bifurcation. You know, we can talk about rates going from current to higher and single aisles, but oh boy, twin aisles. You know, I know Sash before has expressed his doubts about the twin aisle market. And I thought he was being a bit too downcast, and now I'm wondering if he's not right. You know, it just seems it's going to be a really long time before somebody enthusiastically takes a twin aisle. And the idea of Boeing having to clear the decks of, you know, 80-something 787s and resume production at a reasonable rate, and of course, Airbus on the A350, it's really tough to be optimistic right now. Single aisles, sure, absolutely. Let's have a conversation about rates. Twin aisles, this is a very pessimistic moment for me from that standpoint.
Sash, very quickly, Finnish fighter contract and Saab, a program obviously the company is very, very keen on, contested, right? F-35 is in the mix as well.
Yeah, the Finnish fighter contract, best and final offers, although we all know that they're never best and they're never final, but best and final offers were due at the end of April. Interestingly, Saab was the only company that actually publicized this. They had a very good press conference. They talked about, you know, why the Swedish offer was best for Finland, all the stuff you'd expect. I'd just make two points from this, really. One is that we're increasingly thinking that even if the Finns don't buy Gripen, and we think it's likely that they won't buy Gripen, they're likely to buy the Saab GlobalEye airborne early warning aircraft, possibly even as a joint buy with Sweden. And as consolation prices go, that would be pretty good for Saab. And GlobalEye is a very, very differentiated, very, very attractive airborne early warning and broader surface surveillance aircraft for them. Second point I think to make is looking at HX and how the politics is going at the moment. What we're hearing from Finland is that F-35 was quite badly damaged by a lot of the comments that came out from the US and particularly from the US Air Force about availability, about cost of operation, about, you know, maintenance costs and so forth. All of the news flow that came out in the first quarter on F-35 went straight to Finland, and they took it very, very seriously. That being the case, this is looking increasingly like Boeing's to win. F-18EF, that would be the easiest transition aircraft for the Finns because they currently operate early model F-18s, and it would keep them within the sort of the great US security blanket, which, given their proximity to Russia, is just where they want to be.
Absolutely fantastic. Wrap up, Sash, thanks very, very much. And obviously Finland is an F-18 operator, right? I mean, so that the upgrade to the more capable version of the jet would be there. Although there are some who do think that Helsinki will be attracted to the F-35 because it is stealthy, has a lot of data fusion capabilities, and maybe something that, irritates Russia just that much more. But it remains to be seen. And then, of course, right, Stockholm has been working to create this sort of Nordic unity in a way that we've never seen, right, with Finnish staff officers in Stockholm, Swedish staff officers in Helsinki as well. Any last points from anybody before we end it for the week? Going once, going twice, three times? Sold. Everybody, thanks very much. Thank you for joining us. Hope you guys have a great week and looking forward to having you on again next week. Thanks a lot.
Always a pleasure, Vago. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks very much, Fargo.
Great to talk with you guys. Thanks, Fargo.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.